Access number 29549, Mr. John McGough, Reel 4. Now, we talked about the loop. Now, what other aerobatics do you remember? Because there's lots of different types of things. One thing that's mentioned is spinning, or rather it's recovering from spinning,
yeah,
isn't it? What, can you just explain again what spinning is and how you recover from
it? Well, you go to quite a height, about 6,000 or 7,000 feet. You're flying straight and level. You switch the engine off. And, of course, the airplane's got no power. It will start to spin, fall and spin. And as it does, you've got to recover from the spin. It's very simple. Centralise the control column and opposite rudder. So if you're spinning to the left, you centralise the control column and just press the right hand, the opposite rudder, the way you're going. You're spinning, let's press the right rudder with your foot. If you're spinning to the left, to the right, up, press the left one. Very, very simple. Just two simple things. Centralised stick, opposite rudder. That's all we remembered. That was the mantra.
Now, what about side slipping? Because that seems, to people who don't understand airplanes, that's very difficult to understand. How do you do that?
Well, side slipping is where you reduce the speed and drop your wing, and then the airplane will side slip.
Now, you're making the move to the side.
To the side. And your wing is slightly downwards. Your wing is down. It's a one way you can lose height rapidly if you're too high and approaching the runway. If you think you can't get in, you can always side slip and you lose height very, very quickly that way.
Now, what other things do you remember? How about stall turns? Do you stall turns?
Yeah.
Do you remember what they are?
No, I can't remember those. No, can't remember.
Flick rolls? No.
No.
That's enough.
They were just basic aerobatics.
Now, what about restarting the engine in flight? Was that a big thing? Was that difficult, or did you just press a switch?
To be quite sure, I can't remember that either, but I remember doing it, but what we did...
Did you do much navigation flying?
Yes, because before you finish a powered aircraft course, you had to... Before you finish your powered aircraft course, you had a solo cross-country, three-point solo cross-country.
What were cross-country flights like? Did you use the heavens or did you just use the railway lines?
We didn't do any at night time, so we always did them during the day. And we did them by drawing the lines on the map and deciding what compass course you had to get from A to B and B to C and so on. Mine was from, if I remember, it was from, what was the name of the aerodrome we were at?
Sorry, wrong page. Burniston.
My solo cross country was from Burniston to Anstey near Coventry, to Cottesmore, and back to Burniston. So Anstey, Cottesmore, Burniston.
And you had no trouble?
No, I got lost on that first one. I don't know how I got lost. So I landed on the nearest aerodrome, I forget the name of it was, and took off again and then made it back. It was quite common.
Now what about formation flying? Did you have to do any of that?
Yes, I didn't like it.
Why not? What was formation flying?
Well, we used to, in the Tiger Arts, we used to do formation flying in three aircraft. And one formation flight, I remember taking off, and either my colleague or I got out of position, and one aeroplane passed right underneath me and nearly chopped the floor of the aeroplane I was propeller to get out of position. It wasn't very nice. None of us liked that.
Did you get better at it?
You definitely did get better at it, yes.
Now, what about instrument flying? You know, this is where you have a hood, don't you? Did you do any of that?
Oh, yes, plenty of instrument flying.
Now, tell me about that.
You get over the airfield, and the instructor say, pull your hood over, and then, of course, you'll align your instrument. He say to you, fly such and such a compass course for 10 minutes.
This would always be in dual then flying.
Oh yes, always dual.
This hood is just over your.
It's a structure you can't see outside, so you have to rely on the instruments to do as you're told. You say fly for on a certain compass course for perhaps 10 minutes. Then at the end of 10 minutes, you turn onto such and such a course for 12 minutes, and we did varying courses and speeds.
And how did you find that? Were you able to trust it? You
flew on your instruments and your watch for your timing. And then at the end of about 4 or 5 different courses and times, he said to you, estimate me a time and a course back to base. So you give him, and he'd fly it for you. Or you'd fly it, and at the end of the time you were supposed to finish, he'd lift the hood and say, you should be able to see the aerodrome now if you're right. And you either did or you didn't see the aerodrome, if your record, if your estimation was correct.
Did you do any link flying?
Oh yes, plenty of link flying.
Tell me about that. What can you just explain what a link trainer is for people who don't know?
A simulator. It's the forerunner of the modern simulator. Which you could simulate all the conditions of flight in the link trainer.
So it was on the ground. What was it like in it?
It was just like it being in an aeroplane.
It was realistic then?
Very realistic. And you had the hood over and you flew on your instrument courses. And they could put rough air. They put rough air on, so when you're flying along nice and level, start bouncing around. And your compass courses kept altering. And they gave you exercise to fly compass courses, various speeds, and so on.
Now, anything else? You're doing lots and lots of forced landings, and then you change. Lots of gliding approaches. This is going into October now.
Yeah.
I'm just obviously looking at your logbook here. Lots of low flying, forced landings. Any stories you remember from this time?
Oh, yes. I remember once we were flying from Burniston, and it was a slightly obscured afternoon because of semi-mist or fog came down suddenly. And the mist and fog cleared, and I found myself. It's among the barrage balloons over Derby. Flying in amongst the barrage balloons was a hairy. Got out of there rather quickly. We lost our way in the fog and the mist.
Were barrage balloons a real threat?
Well, I don't know much about them, but they were because the forced aircraft. I was able to fly below them, only having a small aircraft. But the danger was you'd hit one of the cables and cut your wing off.
Could you see the cables?
Oh, you could see the cables. We could, but of course.
So you just aim between them.
The forced enemy aircraft to fly over the top.
Which meant they were too high.
Too high.
Now you also go on to the Magister. What did you think of the Magister? What did you think of the Magister compared to the Tiger Moth?
Well, the Miles Magister was a low wing monoplane. The Tiger Moth was a biplane. Now, the great fault of the Magister was a lovely aeroplane to fly that would stall. If you got below your stalling speed, you'd spin in. There was no forewarning. With the Tiger Moth, if you got too near your stalling speed, the aircraft started shuddering. It was telling you, watch your speed, watch your speed. Not with the Miles Magister. The first thing you heard if you got below your stalling speed was the wing dropped and you were gone. That was the great disadvantage of it. It didn't warn you, but the Tiger Moth was like an old friend saying, "Hey, John, watch yourself, you're going to stall."
What else about it? What was good about it?
Well, it was a more modern-looking aircraft. It made you feel a bit more important flying a low-wing monoplane. And it looked the configuration of the airplane was very, very nice, and you felt proud to be able to fly in it.
Did you prefer it to the Tiger Moth when all was said and done, or did you prefer the Tiger?
No, everybody loved the Tiger.
Now, why? Because the other one was more...
I don't know...
What was it then?
Everybody who flew the Tiger Moth just loved it. I don't know why. It was like a trusted old friend. It never let you down. It forewarned you were going to stall with none. The Magister didn't. And you trusted it. And it was so nice to be able to fly it. Mind you didn't fly more than about 80 miles an hour, full throttle, 80 or 90 miles an hour, that was it.
So you carried on flying the Magister into November. deep into November, and then you go back for a bit of night flying. What was night flying like? For you, because it's a bit like instrument flying, but I mean, you know, what was it like?
Well, we've flew on instruments a lot at night. And one peculiar thing I remember about Burniston was when we were night flying on the approach to the landing approach after dark, they had like a traffic light, red, white and green. And if you're in the red zone, you're too high. If you're in the green zone, you're in the right position again, the runway. And if you're in the amber one, you're right. Red, you're too high. Amber, you're on the right track, and green, you're quite safe. It was like flying into traffic lights, reading the traffic lights. It tells you if you're too high, too low, or not safe. I never saw those before or after.
And what was it like landing at night?
Well, once they had paraffin flares right along the runway. And when you were very near touching down, the runway became visible, though not as clear as it was obviously in daylight, and you just carried out your normal landing procedure, no problem.
Now, so you were there, you were there till December, I think, and you flew a fair amount. You finished there in December. No, you finished there in November, sorry. Right at the end of November. Now, you've got a poem you wanted to read that you wrote called Return to Burniston, 17th of June, 1989.
Oh, well,
do you want to read that?
Well, the background of this is...
Tell us the background.
In 1989, Burniston Airfield, which reverted to being a private flying club after the war, was bought up by Toyota. And on the site of what was once Order of Burniston is now the Toyota factory. And before the aerodrome shut down for the last time, those of us who'd served there got an invitation to go. So I went there to see it for the last time. And I just wrote this, if you'd like to hear it. Air experience, cockpit layout, effective controls, these were the first to be studied, I was told. As on Burniston Field, Flying Officer Parker and I strolled to Tigermot 5424, ready nearby. August the 21st, 1942, the first began to fly. The initial step to the coveted prize, the glider pilot's brevet, the line with blue wings, indicating soldier pilots off the skies. Again, I tread the once familiar field after an absence of 47 years. With emotion, pride, and not a little tear, I recall the happy days of Gaubon years, and comrades through some soon to die, who in foreign fields forever lie. Together with those who were once before, and now again are with me here, we discuss the happenings of wartime years. Bill, Jack, Paddy, Taff and Jim, whatever became of them. I study again the familiar faces of course number 12, in course number 12-4, December 42. Young men, vigorous, alert, fit and smart, loyal comrades, men set apart. I paused at the unchanged spot where the photograph was taken, but in my mind we were all together again. But the laughter and chatter exists no more. It's time to move on, time to be gone.
And you wrote that, as you say, after that visit.
I wrote that, yes.
Now,
what do you think of it?
Very good. It's very good of you to read it for us as well. Now, so you finished at Burniston,
yes.
In November. Now, you then go on to, after that, as you qualified. Did it make a difference? I mean, was there a final test before you qualified?
No, Judge, the only time they test you if they thought you weren't making progress, if you managed quite all right through the course, that was it.
Now, so you then go to number 5 glider training school.
At Shobden in Herefordshire.
At where?
Shobden, Shobdon.
And that's in Hereford.
Near Leinster in Herefordshire.
Now, what was the setup at Shobden? This was the RAF training, was it?
The RAF training. This was our first introduction to gliders, military gliders. I'd never seen one until we went to Shobden. And it was the Hotspur carried 8 or 9 men, 2 pilots, a training glider, getting used to training on gliders.
Now, what was your first flight in the Hotspur like? I mean, we've talked about you were used to flying, but you'd go through the same process again, in a way, with the glider, wouldn't you? Now, what was your first flight in a glider like? What did you think of it?
I absolutely loved it. We were towed. I forget the aircraft they used to tow us, but you were towed down the runway. Of course, you got a rope connecting you to the tug aircraft. And the seeker was keeping directly in line behind the tug. If you went to the left, you'd pull him round to the right. If you went to his right, you'd pull him round to the left.
I worked to talk about more about the techniques, wouldn't you? Because you're not flying this time, you're just being taken up for a lift, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
What was it like, first glider flight? Because a lot of people are sick, you know. What
No, it never bothered me. I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And when you're off toward the silence, when you're circling around to come into land again, it was absolutely marvellous. Like a revelation.
Now, tell me about a typical flight then in a Hotspur. So how would you get ready? Because, you know, you go out to your Hotspur, and do you do last checks, flying checks, or what do you do?
No, we didn't do any flying checks. Later on in our training, when we went on the horse guard, we were trained to do inspection flights, pre-inspection flights.
So in the Hotspur, you just get in?
Just get in, because the RAF looked after all that for us.
So what was the takeoff? How was the takeoff done? Because you've got to get the cable, the tow rope on.
Well, the RAF ground crew connected the cables to the tug aircraft, connected the other end to the glider.
So what was the takeoff like? You started telling me, and I interrupted. Tell me about the takeoff.
Well, they connected the cable from the glider to the tug.
Was it an Albemarle? You don't know.
No, I can't remember.
So they collected up.
And then you had an RAF man in front of the tug aircraft. He'd wave a little flag, he'd wave it. And then he'd wave it in a different direction when the slack was taken up. Because if the tug pilot took off too quick, when the rope was slack, it'd break. So he just waved the flag, and the tug pilot knew when he changed the direction of the flag waving, the slack was taken up, then he could open full throttle. And of course, off he went, the glider behind him. Again, you shouldn't get too high. If you got too high,
when you were taking off, you'd have to keep
dead astern, not to left or right, and not too high. If you were too high, you'd pull his tail off and he'd nose in.
So you'd take off first?
Oh, yes, the glider with the instructor. Mind you, with the instructor in the first 2 or 3 lessons. You always got airborne first. Always.
And you have to keep down.
Yeah, they taught you what position was relative to the glider and the tug.
So when you took off, when you both got off, tell me about that. It's high and low, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a high and low tow.
So what's the difference?
Well, a high tow is where you tow. Where the glider's above the slipstream of the aircraft. And the low tow is obviously when it's below the slipstream of the aircraft.
Now, why would you fly in the high one? Why would you fly in the low one? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, well, I don't know the reason, but...
Which would you normally fly in?
99.9% of the time in the high tow position. Because if you went in the low tow position, you had to look up. You know, you're looking up and you get a creak in your neck. Whereas if you're flying in high tow, you're just looking down, it was in a natural position.
Now, when you were there, was it easy flying when you were being towed? Well, what did you have to do? Just follow?
Yeah, it was like, your mind was always concentrating the rope. You must not break the rope, you must not break the rope.
Now, so what do you have to do to avoid breaking the rope?
Keeping the correct position relative to the tug, correct height above him. And not to either side, dead astern in the correct height above them if you're in the high tow. And if you maintain the correct position, it was relatively easy.
Now,
but it was very concentrated because you had to follow every change of course the tug, you had to follow around to make sure you were still maintaining your relative tug position.
Now what about... what controls did you have in the glider? What instruments and controls? We've talked about the timing mark, but what did you have in the glider?
Let me think. You had the altimeter, the turn and bank indicator, the one I told you about, told you the aircraft was flying with the wing low. You had a compass. Of course, no engine controls, no engine at all. Very, very basic instrument.
Did you have the normal, what about your flying column? It was different, wasn't it, not? But wasn't the same. Did you have the spade grip?
Now that, you set me thinking now.
You don't remember?
I don't remember. I don't think so, but don't quote me.
It may be a different model of plane. Yeah. It's only what people have told me. Yeah. So, you had the same flying control, the joystick and rudder.
Joystick and rudder, yes.
So it was pretty well the same. Now, what about casting off and landing? Tell me about how did you cast off, or could the aeroplane cast you off? What was the cast off?
Well, normally the glider pilot cast off because he was responsible for being in the he was responsible for knowing he was in the correct position to give him enough height to land. So when you cast off, that was your decision. The only time the tow cast off was an emergency, anything wrong with them.
So how did you actually cast off? I mean,
it was a red knob. A red knob, you just banged the knob and...
You didn't pull it, you banged it?
We banged it, yes.
And would it... I presume it couldn't be done accidentally then?
Well, it was painted a vivid red that stood out amongst all the other bits and pieces in the cockpit, so you knew to keep your hands off it.
Now tell me about the approach and landing in a glider, because now you're in control. What's it like to fly?
Oh, very, very simple, very, very simple. And like a powered aircraft, each glider's got a stalling speed, and you must maintain your stall above the stalling speed, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. And otherwise, it was no different from landing. But you had to be right first time, because if you misjudged your approach, you couldn't switch on the engine and go round again. We used to pull the other pilot's legs. It's all right for you. You make a mistake, you can go round again, but we can't. There's a bit of banter between us.
Did you find them easy to land?
I found them dead. Very easy to land.
Now, so in your training, you'd fly with the instructor a few times, then you'd go to your first solo. Anything you remember about your first solo? It's not such a big thing, is it?
No, I just can't remember my hospital first solo. Can't remember. As you say, it wasn't such a big thing.
Now, how did you take to it then? What do you reckon of your flying skills with the Hotspur?
Well, I think I was a good Hotspur pilot. And one thing I particularly remember, I don't know if it's relevant to what we're talking about at the moment, flying over the Malvern Hills.
Tell me about that.
Nothing nicer than a beautiful sunny day, taking off from Shobden, flying a few miles over the Malvern Hills. Go over the Malvern Hills and then you see the whole of England spread out in front of you. And many years afterwards, when motoring by the Shobden, by the Malvern Hills with my wife and family, I looked up. I could see a glider on tow, but nobody else could. And, of course, we used to fly just over the top of the Malvern Hills. On a nice day, you'd get all the local girls walking on the hills, and they'd be waving at you, and you thought you were kings of the air. Boosting your morale no end.
Now, a lot of the time, you're just doing standard exercises. It says exercise one, exercise
two. Yeah.
This is just landing, really, isn't it? Taking off and landing. It's in this one.
Yeah, but I've got a cold.
It doesn't...
What the exercise mean?
So each exercise meant something different. There's no point going through them.
No.
Look that up another time. But this is sort of taking off, landing, map reading, cross-country. You did all that as well, though.
Yeah.
But most of the flights are very short, so they're just circuits and bumps, aren't they?
Circuits and bumps, yes.
So
we also did low tows at Shobden, where you flew at minimum height right across the countryside. It was a prepared route out of the way of farmhouses and buildings, but we used to fly at very, very low altitude.
Under tow?
Yeah, they were called a low tow.
And what was that like?
Oh, exhilarating, because... You could always lean out and touch the ground.
Is that low? Well, no.
Yeah, well, literally speaking, about 100 feet, cover on the face.
Now, how does your training go on then? So what's the next stage of it? Because you go into February, January, February. How's your training go?
At the end of the course of training, you kind of the great day when we got presented with our wings.
Now tell me about that. What you were you tested, or was it just you were still there?
You're still there. You'd pass your flat, your Tiger Moth course, you'd pass the Hotspur course, and then they had a parade. You're all lined up, all bulled up, smart uniform, and somebody, I forget who it was in my case, come along and pins your glider pilot wings on your breast.
Now, are these your half wings, your second pilot wings, or are they your full wings?
No, full wings. Second pilots didn't come in at that stage of my training, not until later on in the war.
So that's something that happens later on?
Yes.
And that was a very proud moment then?
Oh, well, obviously. Well, all the effort and sweat and tears we'd done. Well, the first hurdle was getting accepted for training in the first place. And then you got the hurdle of flying Tiger Moths, and you got the hurdle of flying Hotspurs, and you felt you'd achieved something.
Now, how were you getting on with... I mean, your instructors were good there?
Oh, I got the highest respect for the Olive instructor, except for that fellow Irishman I mentioned at Burniston.
So your glider instructors were good? You had no problem with them?
No problem at all. They're all specially picked men. But how Sergeant Harding ever got accepted as a instructor, I'll never know, because he just stood out like a sore thumb. Just pure and simple sarcasm. If I was sarcastic to you, you wouldn't like it, would you?
So overall, you were extremely pleased with what you got.
I've got a great respect for the RAF.
Now, you carry on there training. There's lots and lots of training. I'm just trying to look for when you pass out. It looks like in April.